You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Major chain stores sell a toy pole dancing kit. It comes complete with a tiny garter and fake money. Beauty pageants feature six-year-olds. Girls in areas with no history of eating disorders suddenly become obsessed with their weight. Is there a common thread running through these events? Author Gigi Durham argues there is. She believes these events are connected to media, in particular corporate media, which is intent on sexualizing the behavior of young girls. What results is the distortion of a healthy identity and the erosion of self-respect. Gigi Durham is an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at the University of Iowa. She's also the author of a new book titled The Lolita Effect. She's joined me by phone. Good morning, Gigi.
Morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks. So first of all, maybe you can tell me about what is the Lolita Effect?
Well, in the book, I describe it as the distorted and delusional set of myths about girls' sexuality that circulates widely in our culture and throughout the world. It works to limit, undermine, and restrict girls' sexual progress. And really, as I define it, the Lolita Effect is a set of myths of sexuality that are perpetuated through the mainstream commercial media and marketing that inappropriately sexualizes young girls. The title of the book is also, of course, a reference to the infamous Nabokov novel in which Lolita, the 12-year-old protagonist, is a victim of sexual abuse. Nabokov makes that clear, but we've come to understand Lolita as a precociously and deliberately provocative child. To me, the Lolita Effect is a sort of coercive victim-blaming position that needs to be challenged.
Now, the marketing's aimed at young girls as well as adults. Does this indicate that they have some natural inclination to these products and images?
I wouldn't call it a natural inclination, no, because, I mean, these images, these messages all originate in sort of corporate command centers. You know, it's adults who are creating the messages and circulating them. So, no, I don't think there's a natural inclination. They're being pretty aggressively targeted with these messages.
Now, is this Lolita Effect essentially an American phenomenon?
No, not at all. I mean, the same images are circulating worldwide. So, I mean, I can see effects in America that may be worse than other parts of the world. I mean, we have very high rates of teen pregnancy, higher than any other industrialized country, and we have extremely high rates of teen STDs, too, compared to other countries, even Canada. So I don't think we're handling it very well here.
So now, then, is there a range of depictions in the types of bodies being presented?
No, there is actually very little range. Well, that's one of the things I address in the book, where I have a chapter called Anatomy of a Sex Goddess, where girls, little girls and everyone, we only see one type of body that's positioned as sexually desirable, and we all know what that is. It's sort of that improbable Barbie body with the very slender waist and hips and very large breasts, which is not found in nature. So, no, there's no diversity, and that's one of the arguments that I'm making, that that particular Barbie body is just sort of obliterating a celebration of difference.
Now, there's also a mention in your book of a Thai study, a worldwide study in Thailand. What sort of came out of that?
Oh, yeah. That was an interesting, it was an ethnographic look at teenagers in Chiang Mai that showed that girls experience a lot of stress and depression as a result of Western media's portrayal of sex and gender roles. I mean, and it's really causing a lot of sort of conflict around traditional Thai values, because on the one hand, the teens, you know, they aspire to modern relationships and gender roles where they can date and experiment with sex before marriage. But on the other hand, the Thai culture values modesty and virginity in girls, and so they're being pulled, you know, in lots of different directions by these media influences, the fashions and the portrayals of sex. And so, yeah, it's causing cultural conflict there and elsewhere.
So in your book, you also allude to an interesting case in Fiji. Maybe can you tell us a bit about that?
I know. I think that's like the most interesting field experiment I've ever seen of the Lolita Effect. In 1999, a group of Harvard anthropologists were in Fiji, and they were there when Western television was first introduced. And before that, they had seen almost no incidence of eating disorders of any kind, anorexia or bulimia. But then after television was introduced and the kids started watching Beverly Hills 90210 and Baywatch, they started seeing these spikes in anorexia all over the island. So it was a pretty clear causal, result there from TV.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So to what degree do you think the profit motive is behind this hypersexualization of young girls?
Yeah, I think it's all profit motivated. I mean, a lot of times people ask me, well, why? Why is this happening? You know, and it really is worse now than it was 20 years ago, because people bring up, you know, Brooke Shields and things like that in the 1970s. And yes, I mean, there was a little bit of that, but it's pervasive now, and it is entirely profit motivated. The way I analyze it is that these marketers and media corporations are looking to cultivate cradle-to-grave consumers, and they figured out in the mid-1990s that tweens are just a hugely lucrative niche market, and so they realized that by targeting them with these kinds of images, they can get them to consume very adult products at young ages, and just kind of cultivate them as consumers at very early.
Is this all then wrapped up with just advertising revenue, generating advertising revenue?
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's clearly something that I try to also bring up in the book, is that most, you know, corporate media, commercial media are entirely dependent on advertising for their revenues, which run into billions of dollars a year. And so, of course, their programming has to, you know, support the products that the advertisers are trying to move. And for teen media, especially for media targeted at young girls, those, you know, the fashion industry, the fitness industry, the cosmetics, diet aids, plastic surgery, all this kind of, those are the industries that support those media. And so the messages have to tie into moving those products. Yeah. So it's absolutely about that.
Now, you mentioned this, the Barbie buddy, a few minutes ago, and you've also mentioned the issues that, like in Fiji and in Thailand, of how this sexualization is occurring. Is there a racist element to this this conflict between the Barbie buddy and the cultures and actual reality of women or girls in those cultures?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I mean, I do see a highly racialized component to it. I myself did an analysis of 17 magazine covers in 2006 and 2007, and I found, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but something like 95% of the cover models were blonde and blue-eyed. I mean, and you know, almost all of them were Caucasian, of course, and so, you know, I could only find one or two that were African American or something else, and even those were very light skinned and their hair had been straightened, and so they came close to a Caucasian model of beauty. The Barbie, not just the Barbie body, but all of the the characteristics of beauty that are promoted as being the most desirable are, you know, lightened hair, bleached hair, you know, light skin, fine features, and so all of the, you know, characteristics that might be typical of a different, you know, other racial groups, you know, like curlier hair, darker skin, broader noses, or something like that, and even body types are just not privileged as beautiful or desirable or sexy. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a real racial hierarchy at work there.
You mentioned that the Barbie buddy is one of the, what you call, the five core myths of sexuality promoted by the corporate media. Could you tell me about how that myth fits in and what the other myths are?
The five myths that I look at in my book that I've identified as kind of recurring frequently in the corporate media are, the first one is, I call it, if you've got it, flaunt it, which is that sexuality is all about female exhibitionism. And there's, you know, sort of almost no other way to project sexuality or desirability. It's kind of like the more clothes you take off, the sexier you are, which to me is a really, a very limiting way to define sexuality, which is so complex and so rich. You know, people are attracted to each other for all kinds of reasons. So this sort of pressure on little girls and on women in general to sort of, you know, reveal their bodies as much as they can is problematic, because, you know, how the more naked you are, the more vulnerable you are, and also the less power you have in a way, because you're putting your body on display for male judgment and arbitration, right? So the men get to be the arbitrators of whether your body is acceptable or not. So I find that problematic. The second one is the second part of that, like, if you've got it, flaunt it. So you're only allowed to think of yourself as desirable if you have the type of body that the media has deemed the sexual body, which is the Barbie body. And that, again, is a complete myth, because everyone is sexual. Everyone has the capacity to be in a, you know, in a relationship and to be desirable, to feel desire. And so, again, it's just a sort of ridiculous construction that the more like Barbie you look, the sexier you are. It's just not true. I mean, even medically speaking, speaking. People's levels of desire range according to all sorts of different things. Sometimes I tell my students in college classes that, you know, it's possible that somebody who, you know, who doesn't want to, you know, try so hard to achieve the Barbie body is actually a better sex partner because they're more relaxed and they're not so worried about what they look like, you know. So that's the second myth. The third one is I have a chapter called Pretty Babies, which is the idea that the younger you are, the sexier you are. And I find that really, really troubling, too, because major corporations are using very young models to project desirability and sexuality. I mean, nowadays the models are 12, 13 years old routinely, and they're, you know, they're posed and positioned in these extremely erotic ways, which kind of implies that 12 and 13-year-olds are legitimate, you know, objects of sexual desire. And I don't even think we should go there, you know, like 12 and 13-year-olds should not be. They're not. It's, I mean, of course sex is a normal and natural part of childhood and a part of growing up, but, you know, the way they're circulating these images, it's kind of condoning sexual activity, you know, by very young girls, and that's really not okay. And then the flip side of that I find very problematic, too, is that they're telling older women that the only way that you can be beautiful is if you try to look like a 12-year-old, which is completely impossible and ridiculous. You know, I think it's important to move back to an idea that, you know, adult, mature women are, you know, the most legitimate sexual partners and, you know, also very, you know, fully desirable and fully mature in their sexuality. The fifth myth is, the fourth myth is violence is sexy, and this is also something that's escalating in commercial media aimed at teenagers in particular, where sex and violence are coupled in ways that, you know, sort of link arousal with violence, and that is, again, a very troubling trend that's reflected in rising rates of teen dating violence and so on. The fifth myth I call what boys like, and there the emphasis in almost all these media is on girls pleasing boys sexually, which is also borne out in real-world data where very young, you know, oral sex is happening at young ages in middle school and so forth, and it's always the girls trying to please the boys sexually, and so the focus is completely off of girls understanding their own sexuality, their own pleasures, setting limits, you know, figuring out what their comfort zones are. None of that is happening. So, those are the five myths, and none of them are very progressive.
No, indeed. And, it's, you know, well, they're very troubling, and especially the tying, but they do ring very, very true. So, you know, you've obviously hit on something very significant there, and especially the tying of sexuality and violence seems to be especially, an appalling thing to do at such a young age.
Yeah, really. I had a student in one of my college classes, too, who said those two words shouldn't even appear in the same sentence, you know.
Absolutely. So what can parents, teachers, and others do to promote a healthier identity and well-being for these young girls?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. Actually, there's a lot that we can do. I mean, all of us as caring adults, parents, teachers, counselors, and that's kind of why I wrote the book. At the end of every chapter, I have suggestions on how to, how to open up these conversations with kids and how to kind of help them to challenge the messages that they're being inundated with all the time. So, of course, the first thing you can do is kind of start talking to them about these myths and to point them out as myths. And what I suggest doing is doing it in a respectful way so that they can offer their opinions, you can offer yours. And what I've found in my own work, and I've done a lot of research with girl audiences going into middle schools and talking to girls, is that parents are enormously influential in their lives. That when I meet kids who are sort of queer-eyed and thoughtful and not too impressed with all this stuff, and I say, you know, what is it that makes you like this? They always say usually it's because my mom sat down and talked to me about this stuff, and sometimes it's my dad, but, you know, it's usually some caring adult who's really taken the time with them, so that's really important. The thing I emphasize is media literacy. I think it's absolutely essential that children learn how to critique the media and not just live as passive consumers of the media. You know, we have to be active consumers, we have to be critical, we have to develop a critical consciousness, and kids need to be able to distinguish between the mediated portrayals that are profit-driven and completely fictitious and real life, what happens in real life. And you can start that very, very early. I started it with my own kids when they were like 2 years old. You know, not necessarily about sexuality, but just, why do you think that they're telling us that sugary cereal is so healthy when we know it isn't? You know, just kind of helping them to think about advertising as a construction. Then the other thing I also encourage is for parents and so forth to ask kids to create their own media, which is entirely, you know, so possible now with new technologies. Kids can they can make their own websites, they can make magazines, you know, with color copiers, they can write, they can blog. My own daughter, who's 10, recently wrote a film script and shot a video using our video camera, you know, with her friends. And so, and I think getting kids to make their own media helps them to understand that it is a construction, and they can also create media that might challenge some of these myths, you know, these corporate-driven myths that they're getting. They can also become activists, and I find that's really helpful with teenagers, that if you start talking to them about the plight of girls worldwide, in my book I connect a lot of this with child sex trafficking, child prostitution, you know, those industries are burgeoning all over the world, and so kids can get, especially girls, once they become conscious of these things and they become activists about it, then that can transform their way of thinking too. So there are a whole lot of things that people can do to help kids get past all this.
Well, it certainly sounds like you provide, you know, a fabulous toolkit there, almost for responses to this this really problematic situation. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me about it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
I've been talking with Gigi Durham. Gigi Durham is an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at the University of Iowa. She's also the author of the book titled The Lolita Effect, Why the Media Sexualize Young Girls and What We Can Do About It. You can find more information about this book by going to lolitaeffect.com.